It's back. It's bigger. It's better. It's organizing to create a more mutual and less hierarchical world. The Boston Anarchist Book Fair. This is a family-friendly event with lots of literature and all kinds of other fun and engaging activities. The Boston Anarchist Book Fair will be held on October 19th and 20th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Cambridge Community Center on 5 Callender Street, Cambridge. For more information, visit our website, bostonanarchistbookfair.org, or follow our Instagram, at Boston Anarchist Book Fair. See you at the book fair, comrades.
So, Sean, you're going to Alaska?
I am going to live in the bush.
They have bushes in Alaska?
They got bushes, they got bears, they got whales, they got otters, they got wolves. Presuming they have foxes, too, but I don't know much about it. Never been before. Have
you been?
You're
going on like a... No, I haven't. You're going on like a wildlife cruise to see the polar bears before they drown.
Oh, no. Let's not be depressing about the whole thing. All right. I'm going to see the glaciers, which with God's good grace will be there for at least another 10 or 15 years. I don't know. It's
so
like...
So what's the rush? Why are you going now?
Why am I going now?
You still got 15 years to see that
glacier. Oh, no. But I don't want to see the ending. I want to see it in the middle. And I want to see... I want to see the sights. It's like a vast... American wasteland up there of beauty and primitive forests.
But you're not
going to
see the aurora borealis.
Why do you say that? I was hoping I would.
Isn't that during the winter?
I thought it was like any time. No?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Dude, if I see the aurora borealis, I will flip because I've wanted to see that thing like forever.
That's definitely a life goal of mine. I was so mad when it was visible in New York State, but obviously not in the city.
Yeah, that's so fucked
up. Made me feel like a real sucker. Yeah. But usually I feel like everyone else is the sucker. So it all balances out.
There you go. It all works out in the end. I'm just like, today, this week, just in general, the last week or so has felt like a very official ending of the summer. Because this job I've been working crazy hours on, done. We demobed it today. Job's empty. We're out. Started a new job. They're going to hold my place for me. Labor Day just passed. Going on vacay, gonna come back. I'm hyped. So far, 2024 has been a good year. It was a great summer. Let's have a great fall.
Let me ask you something quick about Alaska. Why did it become a state?
I don't know that. Why would I know that?
Probably because it's got oil. Stuff. You're a history punk. I thought maybe you would know.
I have very little knowledge about it, except that there are still some Inuit people who live up there who are Russian Orthodox.
I didn't know that either.
Like the remainder of Russian Orthodox missions that went over there in like the mid-19th century, which is cool as shit.
Yeah,
I'm going to explore more.
I was looking into this for my book because the inclusion of Alaska and Hawaii into the Union happened around the same time Branch Rickey is pushing to expand the major leagues, which ends up resulting in the Mets. So I thought maybe I can draw some material parallel there between the expansion of states and the expansion of Major League Baseball. But I didn't do enough research to quite figure out
how you might make
Alaska
the connection.
Alaska and Hawaii were included at that time.
Well, we were 48 states, and they were included in what year?
59, I believe.
All right. I have to say it was probably party politics, right? Somebody could
That's how it ended up happening.
Yeah.
Is like it was like horse trading about like, you know, how the votes would turn out, but
I feel like it was a
explain why really.
Yeah, it was like a consolation prize for Hawaii having caught bombs, you know, like 15 years before maybe.
Maybe.
Although I guess like the average Hawaiian wasn't really affected by Pearl Harbor that much except probably the price of housing went up.
Yeah, and there's like hundreds of U.S. bases and other places, like other U.S. territories that never, you know, why isn't Guam a state?
Let's pineapple make Guam a state. Interests maybe in Hawaii and oil interests in Alaska, I'd say maybe.
Yeah.
But you could do that in a territory too,
plausible,
right?
Yeah.
I just think it's sad that if we're going to have a United States, we're not still adding states. I'd like to see like
Trump want to add Greenland, maybe not as a state, but as a territory.
As a territory. No, if you're going to have a territory, you should make it a state. I feel like if you're going to have a state...
Our Puerto Rican friends might disagree with that.
Well, they should put it up to a vote. I think they have before.
Yeah, they do. But the left-wing position is against statehood.
Well, I'm just saying that it's sad that since the 1950s, you know, states have just encrusted. Like, we're not getting any more. you know, and states aren't changing. You had West Virginia broke off from Virginia, but that was fucking in the 1860s, man. What about new states? There should be like a chaos mode for states. Like every 10 years, all the people in the states, the counties get together and they get to like make new states and new maps. That would be democracy.
Well, remember we talked about Greater Idaho, and I'm sure there's some planned 2025 stuff.
You're saying that if we made new states, they'd be racial states in this day and
most
age?
Most likely.
Yeah, probably.
But speaking of plan 2025, did you hear Trump gave us a shout out?
No, to the show? That's really nice. We're not big fans.
Not to
fans,
the show, just our general
tendency.
Oh,
our people.
A subtweet.
Was it he was like Bodega, great thinker.
If you let the Trump tax cuts expire, which he wants to do, she wants to terminate them. If you do that, you will suffer the biggest tax increase in history.
This is him on Hannity.
Tax increase like it. On top of which, well, she wants like to taxes. Add a lot of tax.
Yeah, I don't want to be taxed anymore.
And I've said this a lot.
Now that you're a labor aristocrat, you might have to worry about
that's what I'm saying.
If she becomes president, like 1929, this will be a 1929 depression. She has no idea what the hell
crisis
she's doing.
Theory by Trump.
Capital gains taxes.
Next recession.
She wants to do that. This is where you have something you don't even know what the value is. I tell you what.
Value theory.
If that's going to happen, go out and open an appraisal company, because you're going to make a fortune. That's about the only group that's going to make it, and accountants. It is the craziest idea. And remember this, very rich people and big international corporations, they don't have to stay in the United States. And they will be forced to leave for other countries. They can't afford
He's
to spitting. Do a thing
I
like
can
that.
Stop him.
They He's on
it. They have great wealth and no cash.
Kamala going to stop him? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Where are they going to get the cash? If they do She's that, the unrealized capital gain, it's you know, it's been talked about for a few years by ultra-left Marxists.
Yes.
Like her father's a Marxist. Her father's a Marxist
yes,
teacher.
Yes, yes, yes.
Can you believe this?
But I can believe it.
If that happened, this country, and I think...
This election will be so lit if we are like... litigating ultra-left Marxism in the election. I'm here for it.
Do we talk about unrealized capital gain taxes? I mean, maybe Donald Harris does. I haven't read much of it.
I don't think Donald Harris goes in for that sort of shit. I haven't read it either. No, I've never posed that as a policy solution for anything. I'm familiar with the arguments for it and against it, but no, I don't think that... ill will is coming out in favor of it anytime soon, or you know, the international communist current,
the Dutch German left folks, they've been plotting this for years.
The Dutch German left folks, they're gonna make you pay your taxes on your unrealized gains. That means you have to sell part of your company. How are we gonna make it that way?
They're calling it an infantile disorder.
Just waving the fucking book around. Dude, that'd be so lit. I think that American Communist Party, I think that's like, that's their wet dream, is that Trump just like comes out as a fucking, as like a right-wing Marxist.
He said some stuff before about how he likes AMLO. Maduro's a tough cookie. Obviously, he loves Kim Il-sung.
Yeah.
Kim Il-sung. Is that the current president of North Korea?
President is saying it lightly.
The current god.
yeah,
he does seem, he seems like more of a Juche figure to me than a, but.
He's a businessman, so the untaxed capital gains thing hits him right where it hurts, right? Because he's all about inflating asset prices, right? That's like his bread and fucking butter, at least since he went bankrupt in the 1980s. So this is like the perfect foil for him.
In the last year, I've made one friend who is like a resistance lib, like around my age, and I love her. Like, we share anti-Trump memes.
Oh, sure.
Like,
it's like me and my stepfather. Yeah,
it's great. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, lock him up. I told her, like, you know, the vast majority of people who vote for Trump are just voting for lower taxes.
Yeah.
Like, even if they're actually not gonna benefit from like the Trump tax cuts because they are middle class or working class, they still just believe that the Republicans cut taxes, the Democrats raise them. It doesn't matter what Harris says. They just think that that's true.
Yeah.
And so we can't, I don't know, it's hard to be too moralistic about that because they don't give a shit about anyone but themselves and their family and their bank account. And So it's not really about anything else than that. That seems to be like the more decisive or like the more equalizing feature in the elections.
Yeah, I mean, God, it's so fucking like 1992, 1994, 2000, 2004, 2008. I mean, this is like the constant running theme in American politics, right? Is taxes or our lower taxes. All I know is I worked a Saturday and a Sunday last week, and I got hit with a tax bill that was in the mid four figures, and it fucking hurt, man. That income tax really hurt. And I don't even make that much money, but if you make a whole bunch in overtime, they tax you as though you make like $350,000 a year, so you get fucking hammered.
You know who else wasn't a big fan of taxes?
Who's that?
Karl Marx.
Karl Marx, yeah.
But I think he was talking about a sort of different kind of tax. I don't know. I don't think he was talking about like the taxes that the ultra wealthy have to pay, like Trump is talking about.
Would a socialist party, if there was a real one in this country, fight for higher taxes or lower taxes? I think everybody assumes that you'd want higher taxes, right? Because you want the state to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But maybe, you know, like that old time socialism, you'd actually want to like cut taxes to starve the beast and let like the socialist workers movement kind of take the reins of things, not the bourgeois state. I don't know.
I mean, I think we got to expropriate the rich somehow. There's
taxes ain't going to do it,
like,
though.
25 million millionaires in this country. And yeah, I don't think you can tax all that wealth away without within the current order.
Oh, you can't. I mean, that's like what the problem and like libertarian right wing types will point this out. And I kind of joked about it badly earlier, but like unrealized capital gains, when you have rates of profit that are pretty low, like 1-2% on like industrial capital, and you have a bunch of people making money by asset inflation, and that kind of grows a whole bunch of the American economy and the GDP. Unrealized capital gains means that someone's like, that's not liquid money. So if people are going to pay gains on like their Tesla stock going up $1 million in one particular year, they got to pay 28% on it. They have to come up with $280,000. So the argument is like, well, that's actually going to hurt investment in things, because the rich who would otherwise have their money invested in cycling through production or money making or whatever it is would be forced to pull that out, and the government would take a chunk of it, which like again in a period of low profits could kind of be a problem. So maybe Trump is the radical ultra leftist, because ultimately he sees a low rate of profit, he says let's make it lower. Let's give that to the state so that they can, I don't know, what would the state do with all that money? I guess pay off the deficit.
I don't think anyone cares about that. And I'm really unclear about like how taxes even matter at this point. I mean, I understand that the government receives a lot of taxes and spends it, but they also just print a lot of money because the dollar is the reserve currency. So it's very unclear to me, and I think to increasingly the average person, like what taxes really do or matter besides a political cudgel to say we can't afford this.
Yeah.
Or they're going to raise it.
Or like the assertion that everybody has skin in the game, right? That like people like you or me who are not wealthy people, like we pay in, you know, so that we're like contributing to the general wealth of society or whatever through our income taxes or property taxes if you own property. But I'm with you, man. Like at this late date, the entire global economy rides on like the American dollar being strong and the American state not going bankrupt. I'm not an MMT guy, but I feel like tax receipts, like, I'm sorry, you're never going to get enough tax receipts to pay down our crazy deficit. So if we're going to have bourgeois politics, and that's like all that's on the agenda right now, Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump, I say I want to pay less taxes, and I want all my listeners out there to pay less taxes. Andy, I want you to pay less taxes. I don't give a fuck about the wealthy people, but even if they pass this goddamn capital gains minimum fucking tax thing, they're not going to pay it anyways. So they have the accountants to avoid it. And like, there was a great meme the other day that it's like, oh, you say the American dollar's fiat currency and it's not backed by anything. And then they showed like a GIF of that like automatic like air defense gun that shoots 50 millimeter shells, like a thousand of them a minute. And it's like, this is what's backing up the dollar. And ultimately that is what that and like the productive capacity of the United States is what backs up, you know, our federal government and our economy. So
yeah, it also freaked me out in that video how much just like normal bullets cost, because I've been to shooting ranges before, but I've never like bought a gun or bullets or had one, so I didn't realize how expensive that shit was. But
it's expensive, man.
Yeah,
and the U.S.
I guess it should be.
Like that old.
That makes my like fantasies of going out to the desert and just firing off an AR-15 at some cans a little bit less enticing to me.
Well, that was the Chris Rock bit, wasn't it? It's like you make a bullet worth like $1,000, and people are going to think twice before they fire one off.
Good point. Kamala should integrate that in the campaign. And I guess just one more thing about this. Like, I think another thing Trump is kind of right about here when he's talking about capital flight is Biden sort of marketed himself as this post-neoliberal figure, Bidenomics. And there was things to back that up besides the industrial policy, which is fairly tepid. You did see pretty strong SEC.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the breakup of blocking of mergers and, you know, this recent ruling against Google. All this stuff is, you know, a little bit more of a muscular Fed than what we came to expect from neoliberals. But
not to mention the NLRB as well, a strong NLRB.
But it does appear that Kamala is really tacking back to an old school neoliberalism of like her solutions for working class people are putting more investment into starting small businesses and tax credits and deregulating housing to solve the housing crisis.
Yeah, like a classic petty bourgeois politics.
So when he calls her out for like, well, if you raise, by the way, and her capital gains tax raise is like 10% less than what Biden proposed.
It was really?
Like 28 instead of 38.
She's already bargaining it down.
Yeah, huh? So she's already bargaining it down. And, you know, I think Trump is right. Like, people are going to avoid paying taxes, including taking capital out of the country for as long as possible if they need to. And is Kamala going to stop them?
Well, who can stop them, really? I mean, if anyone could...
The U.S. government can stop them?
I mean, they could try to find ways to stop them.
Of course they can. Yeah, of course they can.
No, we'll see about that. I don't know. I feel like they can only be stopped using measures that might blow the entire thing out of the fucking water, because it's ultimately like political and economic at the end of the day. So I feel like even the U.S. state, and I think you see this every day, is very wary about the interests of national capital, and also tries to balance that with the interests of international capital. And I don't mean that just in like American finance capital that has its like tendrils all over the globe, but like Western capital in general and like capitalists in the quote unquote developing world. The United States' mission, you know, global mission is to try to ensure that free markets function and that like petty capitalists and large capitalists are able to acquire the resources and the cheap labor power necessary in order to increase production. I feel like this whole globalist versus like national conservatism thing is of course a red herring, because American politics is fucking stupid. This election is fucking stupid. You've been following this election more than I have. I mean, I've been like watching little clips here and there, but fundamentally, it doesn't seem like there's really any change on the agenda. I feel like Harris is going to continue to bargain down Bidenomics and then maybe include some sort of like inclusivity clauses into things similar to Biden did, maybe more, maybe a little bit less. And Donald Trump is just going to be the businessman guy who's like Mitt Romney, but with tariffs, you know, or George Bush with tariffs. There's like nothing new under the sun. There was the possibility in 2016 that a new politics might arise, but we're like so far from that now. We're 8 years out from that. And it's just sort of like Trumpism, what's left of Trumpism, just being completely like synthesized and by like an engorging Republican Party, which is trying to use this to run policies that are very similar to ones that they've done before, but like with a little bit more nationalism in it.
Well, I've made this case before, and I'll just close the election talk on this, is that I do think that there are some real conservative revolutionaries in the Republican establishment, including in Trump's campaign. J.D. Vance is one of them. And there's not in the Democratic establishment.
So, that's true.
So yeah. Like we can say like, oh, it's all going to be the same as it always was. But one party takes power way more seriously than the other.
That's true.
And but that's a problem for the Democrats, because when Trump says Kamala is going to be too weak to follow through with her stuff, that makes sense to people.
I don't even know if I agree with that, honestly. I feel like the power of the Democrats is more broad-based and more profound than the power that, like, J.D. Vance thinks he might wield. I feel like the Democrats and the deep state are kind of synonymous with one another, the administrative state or whatever. And I feel like you saw under the first Trump administration, like, there's all sorts of ways for, like, the Democrat-aligned forces, political and economic forces, to fight back even against like a J.D. Vance who's able to garner enough votes to become president maybe in 8 years or whatever. I don't know. I'm very cynical about the ability for like bourgeois politics to change, but I think it's a very serious realignment right now between the two parties.
I mean, I think we've seen it change in our lifetime. The Supreme Court and the judiciary in general is one example of being totally out of balance as a Republican power play. And I think we can expect to see way more of that. I also disagree that the deep state is like the Democratic Party. I think it's a cross-party coalition of bureaucrats.
Yeah.
And they want to root out the Democrats from it.
I think, yeah, that's true. I think I wouldn't say just Democrats. That was very glib to say. But like from like the center right George Bush deep state people to like the center left Kamala Harris people, like that's your deep state, like the vital center, the neoliberal center. Sure. And that's what's under threat.
Sure.
But also those center right people are moving to the Democratic Party anyways. So to end election talk, we'll have to keep an eye on it.
I think they're still voting for Trump.
Oh, yeah, we'll see.
Anyway, let's maybe move on to Israel because, you know, we often talk about strikes on this
strikes.
Show. We do strike updates, and there was a very brief general strike in Israel this week, and I think it's worth talking about.
Proletarians of the world unite.
Yeah, so on this weekend, six of the hostages were, I don't know if they were discovered or announced that they were dead. Israel says Hamas executed them because they were closing in on rescuing them. Hamas says that they died in an airstrike, and that led to a renewed anti-Netanyahu protests.
A huge outpouring of grief, like really pulling at this conflict, this tension within Israeli society between like make a deal to get the hostages home and like continue to prosecute this terrible genocidal war.
Well, no, I think the protests were pro-ceasefire. Now pro-ceasefire could mean temporary ceasefire to release the hostages, then continue the genocide. I don't doubt that a large amount of people there are just want the war to end and things to go back to normal. And that's not because there's a high percentage of peaceniks in Israeli society. We know from opinion polling and the elections that is not the case. But Israeli societies and the economy are in big trouble right now. Pull up this article from Al Jazeera.
Yeah, there's like, as you bring it up, there's tens of thousands of businesses that are going under. You've got massive labor market disallocations. You have tons of people who have fled the country or been unable to continue farming in the north as they did with their settlement colonies up there or whatever. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is from Al Jazeera. The Bank of Israel has estimated the war-related costs for 23 to 25 could amount to $55.6 billion. These funds will likely be secured through a combination of higher borrowing and budget cuts. Before the outbreak of the war, Israel's economy was forecast to grow by 3.5%. In the end, output expanded to just 2%. An even sharper drop was avoided thanks to the country's all-important tech sector, largely unaffected by the fighting. And I know a little bit about this because I write in co-working spaces, and one of them has a lot of Israelis there. And I think that a lot of them have just come over during the war.
They're like dual citizens and they want to escape the war.
Maybe they're just like working here a short time just because it's like unpleasant to be in Israel right now.
I can imagine.
The article continues, roughly 60,000 Israeli companies will close this year due to manpower shortages, logistics disruptions. That's the Houthis. But also, you know, flights not coming in regularly because of the threat of a regional war and subdued business sentiment. Investment plans have in turn been delayed. At the same time, tourist arrivals, huge part of the economy,
yeah,
continue to fall short of pre-October levels.
Is this a good time to go to the Holy Land?
Israel has also imposed strict controls on the movement of Palestinian workers,
uh-huh,
foregoing up to 160,000 workers. To tackle these shortages, Israel has been running recruitment drives in India and Sri Lanka with mixed results.
Mm.
But labor markets remain undersupplied, particularly in construction and agriculture.
Remember that some of the casualties of the October 7th assault were Thai migrant workers, right? You and I actually discussed that off the bat, how there's like this like international like lumpen proletariat that ends up moving to different countries, and it kind of depends on what country it is. Like,
I would say
underclass.
That they're just the straight up proletariat.
Yeah, they are.
They're not lumpen.
No, I guess I only said lumpen because they're like necessarily transitory and like have their passports taken away at the border. So they're like, I don't mean it as a slur, but only like they have even less ability to shake their chains than like a Palestinian, or maybe the same amount as a Palestinian, but less than an Israeli Arab person, for example.
There's differing definitions of that term, but certainly the underclass, the non-citizen class of Israel. Garside noted, this is someone they quoted in the article, an economist, I think, "We are yet to see any major cutbacks to other parts of the budget, like healthcare and education, although it's likely that cuts will be made in the aftermath of the conflict." So this is also part of what's behind the anger at Netanyahu, is that he's going to have to pay for this war through austerity measures.
Oh, yeah.
There's been speculation that Netanyahu is delaying his fiscal package, which may prove domestically unpopular. Failure to pass a budget by March 31st, 2025 will automatically trigger snap elections.
Yeah, the Israeli state is a crazy beast. Their politics is crazy because they don't have a constitution. And why don't they have a constitution? Because they'd have to put like what we call settler colonialism like into the law. So they've kind of punted on that. You know, they have like the normal laws that they have, which are kind of based upon the original labor Zionism of like the 1950s. But like putting things in writing is kind of dodgy. So whenever I look at Israeli politics and what's happening there, and even like Israeli civil society, I always have to kind of other it a little bit, because it's like, it's a democratic country, but it's like not a normal country like we would imagine it. Not a normal politics and like not a normal society.
Well, there are many ways that it's not a normal country, but many ways that it is. And obviously when we look at opinion polls and elections, like we said, like the overwhelming sentiment of Jewish Israelis is pretty horrifying.
Sure.
But I would like us to challenge ourselves and the listeners to maybe like, let's think about these general strikes in a non-moralistic way.
Yeah, and I appreciate this, the soliloquy that you're about to give, because I found a real like dearth of commentary on this online. I feel like, you know, I only really pay attention to like Twitter or what's left of it, like the Twitter left. And like there wasn't much going on about this because, of course, the reality of like an Israeli workers general strike and a political one intersecting with, of course, like the very strong and real and, you know, important sentiments of leftists around this issue of Israel and Palestine means that I feel like people are getting kind of jammed up. You know, like, do I support workers? You know, but I can't support them. They're Israeli workers. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about this, because I feel like it's important to comment on it.
Well, I think the reason that we look to the working class is not because they're good people necessarily.
Yeah, sure.
We certainly don't think that they have good socialist politics, you know, like at moments in history they have. But, you know, when we support a strike, we don't assume that all of those people are internationalists, for example, or anti-war or whatever politics we like. We support the working class as a sort of part of this objective process that's inherently not about morality. It's about what moves workers to fight for themselves. And this is an example of that, but because of the particularities of the Israeli context, we have to look at the general strike a little bit closer. But that's also true of any general strike. You know, I was in Greece one time, and there was this general strike of truck drivers that made it hard for me to get around because, like, the gas stations were all out of gas.
And like an American, you're like, what the fuck? I want to get somewhere. I got to use some petrol. I'm American.
Well, you know, I'm not used to that kind of strike, so that was annoying. But also, when I finally got to Thessaloniki and stayed at the anarchist squad, I was like, oh, great, general strike. What's up with that? And they're like, yeah, it's a fascist general strike. These people are against non-Greek workers getting work permits.
It was a hate strike, or like the strike, the trucker strikes against Allende.
Well, I you know, I'm not going to like comment too much on the particularities of that strike, but it's just like any general strike, we don't just cheer it because of the words. You know, we have to look at what it is and try to make a sober analysis of
it.
Strikes are always caused by some extent by the material conditions of the working class. And in this case, to me, it appears mainly the contradictions of Israel's war economy. And so because Zionism wants to, you know, it has this labor Zionist tradition, right? That imagines a class of society for Jews.
Right.
And so it's a inherently, it's not socialist now, of course, but it has this long tradition and these institutions that come from this highly nationalistic socialism.
Like the Jewish conquest of labor. No, like the kibbutzim, right? Yeah. Like the production of society, the production of an Israeli state, like through the labor of the people. It's like an old Zionist sort of trope.
That labor Zionism, ironically, through its like insistence on like this classless vision of the Jewish state, covers up the class contradictions. And I think that's what we see in this general strike. So it was called by this major union,
Histadrut.
Yeah. And I'm a little shaky on this history. I read some books on it, but that was like before I went to Israel, like 15 years ago now. But I believe that was like the central organ of the labor Zionists when they were hegemonic, like before the foundation of the Israeli state.
Yeah, from 1920, I think they were formed in like 20 to 29 was like kind of the golden age under the mandate.
And their vision was that that would be the state. I could be wrong. Correct me in the comments if I'm confusing this. But yeah, I think the labor Zionist vision was that the state would be run by this union. And there were people involved in labor Zionism that saw it as being not only Jewish, that Arab workers would be included as equal members of that. But as far as I understand, that simply never happened. And I'm unclear if there was ever really a legitimate attempt at that. But certainly now that does not seem to be the case at all.
Although, well, I have some documents to show on that front, but I'll let you continue.
Yeah, so this union now is undoubtedly pro-war itself. They are part of the war economy. They make weapons. I don't know what percentage of the Jewish Israeli working class is involved in it, but I think it's
800,000, I think they have, out of a population of, what, 10 million? So it's like a similar rate to like the AFL-CIO, maybe.
I was trying to find out like the class composition along ethnic lines, and I couldn't really find that. Maybe if someone has some resources for that, they can let us know. But it wasn't just this union involved. There was heavy participation from the tech sector and the Manufacturing Council. So there's a cross-class collaboration here. There appears to be little input from the lowest rung of workers, these immigrant workers, the Palestinian workers, especially the non-Israeli citizen Palestinian workers. Zionism has a strong tradition from its socialist roots of believing in this class of society, and I think the cross-class collaboration here is maybe a result of that. It's like, well, the Manufacturers Council and the union are all on the same page, and also the union itself, I think in its heyday, owned a lot of the Israeli national economy. I think it owned like the central bank and, you know, several other key industries and infrastructural projects. I'm not sure if it still has that power today, but this is sort of more than just like the AFL-CIO calling a general strike.
There's like a corporatist element to it, right? Because it takes in like entrepreneurs and stuff too. Is that?
Well, I think the tech sector is separate. I'm not sure how much that is like unionized in this or other unions, but my impression from the tech sector is it's a lot of, you know, founders, owner operators,
right,
or partners in these companies. And the tech sector is a pretty major player in Israeli politics, and they tend to be more towards the center.
Like big part of their economy, right, is tech, is apps and tech, like chips and high technology and all that stuff.
All that bullshit.
Yeah, all that shit we hate. Not because it's Israeli, but because it's tech.
So, yeah, I think that this general strike represents this vision of like a unitary society opposed to a more reactionary minority represented by Netanyahu, the settlers. And it's not such a minority because they're constantly winning or tying elections. And they're incredibly militant, incredibly mobilized.
And fascist, let's just.
But it does indicate, yeah, they're these are fascists, but it does indicate a real cleavage in Israeli society that was bubbling up during the judiciary protests before October 7th. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of an extension of it with sort of higher stakes, not only because of the genocide going on, but what's more pressing, I think, in average Jewish Israelis' minds is that this economic crisis that's staring them down and this delegitimization worldwide at the hands of the Netanyahu administration. And I think if it was, you know, their preferred candidate would be doing much of the same stuff, but would be finessing it more.
Right.
Would be doing it in a way that could make liberals worldwide happy, you know, not getting like Turkey and Norway to like, or the UK to stop weapon shipments.
Like 1990s Zionism.
Not get ICJ and ICC cases.
Yeah.
The center, I think, could handle this better. And that's a major stake for your average Israeli, even one who, you know, wants to press a button and get rid of every Palestinian.
Oh, I saw that video too, yeah.
And so this is not, I don't think this is like a particularly controversial statement. I think this is exactly what Hamas thought that they were doing with this strategy of hostage taking. In the past, hostage taking has allowed them to negotiate for their own prisoners. They were even able to negotiate the return of a single dead body for like a few hundred prisoners. And I think that they understood, even if Netanyahu wasn't going to play into prisoner exchanges, that if he didn't, those contradictions within Israeli society would blow up as they are now. So this general strike happened on Monday. It lasted for a few hours. It was fairly widespread besides the union in the tech sector. I think all the bus companies went on strike and the schools went on strike. I think there was like student participation too. So this all happened until the Israeli labor court ruled the strike illegal. And then the strike part of it ended, but there continued to be demonstrations every night, including a video I'll put in the show notes of protesters setting highways on fire and then blocking police from putting it out to try to increase the disruption. They tried to break into Netanyahu's presidential palace or whatever at some point and got through like one line of police but didn't get any farther. So it's not simply a quiet general strike. It's pretty aggressive and pretty angry, and I think it's something that's worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah. I think you know, a profound thing you said earlier was to try to tie this to the divisions we saw in Israel previous to October 7th in the judiciary shakeup that Netanyahu and his like crazy ultra white right wing coalition was trying to push through. I feel like these tensions, of course, have simmered like under the surface. I think that similar to the way that the judicial reform versus the people who wanted to keep the judiciary, this like old labor Zionist judiciary as a central part of like a defense of the Jewish state against these sort of right-wing revisionist Zionists, I think this is finally now fucking almost a year into this thing, that tension breaking out into plain sight again. It takes the form of appearance of ceasefire in order to turn the hostages down, to return the hostages. But it's like fundamentally, as the president of Israel Herzog said previous to October 7th, there was a state of like pre-civil war in Israel. The president of the country said, like, we're not talking like a low intensity civil war. We're talking like armed settlers, like versus the army. Mm-hmm. That, of course, has been submerged due to all the chaos and all the genocide and all the fighting and all the disruption after October 7th. But after the dust clears here, and I think a lot of people were hoping that Israel would be destroyed by now. It's not destroyed yet. Probably never will be, right? After the dust settles from this, after all the tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are dead, the hostages are all either returned by a ceasefire or also dead from Israeli bombs or being executed or whatever, these tensions aren't going to go away. The way I see this thing, and I'm going to bring up some primary source documents right here, this is the Histadrut website. The About Us part of it. And this is in English. So cynical people can be like, well, obviously they're just saying this to appeal to a Western audience or whatever. But I feel like you should take people at their word. The stuff in here is expressing solidarity and support for unions and confederations that government and private sector companies trample on the rights of the workers, blah, blah, blah. Solidarity since 1995 for the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions. This is his to root. In a unique agreement that's unparalleled in the world, that in its framework, 50% of the treatment fees of Palestinian workers employed in Israel are transferred to the Palestinian Trade Union Federation, up to $32 million of that. His to root, there's another document, strives to help Palestinian and foreign workers. Palestinian workers are among the most vulnerable and exploited workers in Israel. The Histarut is committed to strengthening the relationship with the Palestinian Trade Union Federation and protecting and campaigning for the rights of Palestinian workers employed in Israel. As part of collective agreement, grievance committees are convened and settle thousands of disputes. In 2019, Histarut unionized approximately 5,000 Palestinians, blah, 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 going on. So on and so forth. This is a crystallization, I think, of the old regime that's dying, the one you pointed to, labor Zionism. There's this holdover that exists, and it was tied to the Israeli communist left and socialist left. And nowadays, as we know, those forces in the Knesset can only get like maybe 5 or 6% of the vote. But similar to how like the Bayard Rustin AFL-CIO or like the Walter Reuther CIO back in the day represented like a potent social force that had like a strong power within, say, the Democratic Party in order to like help form policy and push politics and the economy forward. This Israeli Trade Union Federation still kind of exists in the wings, and it has 800,000 members, but increasingly its power is atavistic, it seems like, right? And all the forces of settlerism, the Ben-Gaviers of the world, certainly the Netanyahus of the world, through the judicial reforms are attempting to like put an end to this entire regime that existed from like, you could say the 1950s all the way up until like, you know, 5-10 years ago, right? And so what we should see this general strike as is not like some revolutionary proletarian wave in order to like create international communism, nor should we see it as like a cynical move by like just these bloodthirsty settlers to try to get like their hostages home, damn the Palestinians. Instead, we should see it as a reflection of the contradictions within Israeli society and understand that what the Trade Union Federation represents, what these striking workers represent, is fundamentally and ultimately like an entire regime of accumulation, an entire political regime of old labor Zionism that is in its death throes and attempting in some small way to hold off its ultimate extermination, which will probably come within the next 5 to 10 years. Might not happen in a shooting war, but it's happening on the ground right now. The way that like the entire after October 7th, you mentioned that Hamas assumed this is going to be like a normal thing. We could have like a prisoner exchange. We could have a ceasefire. We could negotiate after. The terms changed. And the terms changed, you know, despite the fact that Netanyahu has been the prime minister in Israel when these sort of things have happened before, not merely because October 7th was such a big deal, but because there's been a phase change within Israeli society, within politics in Israeli society, where the old rules from like the 1990s or the various different intifadas no longer hold, and you now have an exterminationist Israel politics that is more and more taking the lead, a politics that's not rooted in labor Zionism and the conquest of labor and the Jewish class of society, but instead a much darker, very much darker, genocidal vision that doesn't really have a place for like the Histarutes of the world, let alone the Golda Meirs or the Moshe Dayans of the world, right? It's moving past that. It's moving beyond that into a very, very sick place.
Yeah, I mostly agree. I just think that the causes of this current like fascistic trajectory represented by Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir comes from that nationalist insistence in, you know, this the socialist vision. And nationalism's a poison. And if you've got a as nice as it is that the union put that stuff on their website and like maybe it's true, the fact that they are so chauvinistic about manufacturing the destruction of Gaza and now the West Bank, there's the war has extended officially. The IDF has officially extended the West Bank as a theater of war, and proceeding to do very similar kinds of displacement on the people living in the West Bank as well. I think this the inevitable result of nationalism.
That's where you and I completely agree, because I wasn't saying that to try to apologize for the former regime. It's instead the kind of logical conclusion of this pseudo-socialist conception of a classless Jewish society that you could create through like strong syndicalist trade unions and kibbutzim, but that always at the end of the day, because it's a pseudo-socialism, relies on like a national division of labor and an ethnic division of labor, a religious division of labor, an ethno-supremacism that like, it's not like one displaced the other, that like Ben-Gavir displaced Moshe Dayan and what was her name? I just mentioned her. Those old labor, Golda Meir. But instead, this is the culmination of this very logic. Like, despite what these people claim they were doing, it's the culmination of the Zionist vision.
The concept of Greater Israel comes from labor Zionists after the 67 war. It's not like Likud inserted these reactionary politics.
So you and I agree on that, right? Like there's something like very like deeply logical about the way that this thing has worked out, given the political divisions within that society and the necessity of having a Jewish state, as like a supremacist Jewish state in the 21st century.
And I think the contradiction that sort of remains even at this late moment when Israel has moved on to just unapologetic genocide is that there is this cosmopolitan tendency in Israel it's mainly expressed in the tech sector, but the immigrant working class is also an element of this, of people who understand either ideologically or culturally, but also economically, that Israel needs to be linked to the rest of the world, and that's just going to be harder and harder if they're seen as this genocidal state.
That's like another fundamental tension right there, right? Is as you said, like you need the rules-based international order to recognize your ethnic state on the one hand, you need international capital to be able to invest, you need to export capital, you need to have like the world open to trade and the ability to work or whatever. But at the same time, inexorably, year by year, like the fundamental basis, the political basis and economic basis of your state leads you to like leave the community of nations, and do things that have been for good reasons considered unacceptable since the Second World War.
Unless, and this is Netanyahu's plan, I think, is to aid and make alliance with the other Netanyahus of the world.
Right.
Trump, Le Pen, Maloney,
Orban, Putin,
Bolsonaro. So there's like a kind of new world order of these fascistic strongman leaders forming. I think the liberal democratic rules-based order or whatever still retains, even though they're, full of shit and aiding and abetting the right, they still retain this conception of a neoliberal global free market.
I would love to see the molding and crying and pissing and moaning and shitting when Israel joins the BRICS on the part of the gray zone people, like Israel becomes the centerpiece of the new BRICS, right? Like, I mean, yeah, you're right. There is a different global order that Israel can like glom onto, and that vision, that future is like, it's just through a keyhole right now, but it's possible if they continue the ethnic cleansing and the absolute destruction of the West Bank and Gaza, who will they have left to ally with? I suppose, like, I don't know, Russia, Iran. Who knows? It's we're in a phase change, and
that's
like
a beautiful vision.
Yeah, isn't it though? Like unity in the Middle East, but only through like
obviously regime change in Iran is a high priority for them.
Yeah.
And it's a good question about how Putin and China work with that. I mean, Putin likes to saber rattle And China acts like a mediator, but who knows what kind of conversations are going on behind the scenes. I think Putin at least is a very kind of real political actor.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of deal can we make?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem super ideological to me, aside from the Russian national.
And they have pretty good relations with Israel. I think it's like Russia and Israel. I think it's like
officially they have good relations. But it's, you know, I don't know, at least their media puts out a lot of criticism.
Well, we're hypostasizing Israel and we're hypostasizing Iran and Russia because there are states that exist and there's like ruling class interests in those places, but there's also like the deep divisions of class society in all these different places. So like we don't argue that like an unlimited Israeli Hizdarut general strike is going to lead to communism, because like the fucking institutional and political forces to push that through don't exist at that moment in time. Instead, as like realists and communists as the adults in the room, we have to look at these societies as riven by class divisions, try to understand the ways in which, like, even in the darkest circumstances, partisans of the proletarian vision, right, can understand a way out that doesn't involve more nationalism, that doesn't involve like creating a BRICS that's going to bring like state capitalism and socialism to the world, but instead imagine a way that like the proletariat can unite across, say, national lines. Mm-hmm. And you say that, of course, and like the people on the left on Twitter get really mad. Like, you're saying the Palestinian working class should just like give up their fight and ally with the racist Israeli working class. It's like, well, nobody thinks that's going to happen right now, right? But that is a political vision we should want to fight for.
I think they might if they could. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Like, that racism prevents that from happening.
Yeah.
And another aspect of it is even if we say that, you know, all of these Israelis going on strike and marching and rioting are simply racists, whatever motivating to do that is putting some limits on what Israel's able to do right now.
True.
And so it's good that they're able to do that. This is another case where you want, even if you can say a million horrible things about the Jewish Israeli working class, it would be good to see them succeed and grow more powerful, even with this centrist position that they
inhabit,
crushing them just means a freer hand for the fascists.
Right. And like, even if the English language shit that I read off from their website, you know, about us, the Israeli Trade Union Federation, is just cynical bullshit to like appease a Western audience or like a liberal audience abroad, like, make them fucking live up to it then, at least, you know, make them fucking actually do something about it, which it seems like, you know, I don't know. There might be a possibility in the future, but not if the Ben-Gavirs and the Netanyahus of the world succeed, and the United States seems to be doing as much as it possibly can to make sure that happens.
All right. I'm sure listeners will have a lot to say on this subject.
Yeah, and we're sorry if this was too much.
Please, but, you know, if we've gotten something wrong, or if you have some more information for us about Israeli class composition, especially, and or your views on the subject, just chime in the comments or on the Discord.
I have in our notes here, I said, we need an expert on Israeli labor and labor Zionists to make Zionism to make sense of the politics of these people, blah, blah, blah. Like, we're fully aware that we're not only thousands of miles away from there, but also like worse than amateurs when it comes to this sort of shit. But like, as far as we see the news, I think that, you know, it's good to get like a different take on it. And I like to think that ours is.
And, you know, one other thing I want to talk about, we don't have much time to really talk about it in depth, is there was a pretty good expose on Drop Site News, which is sort of a spinoff from The Intercept about the recent elections in Ecuador.
Ecuador, yeah.
And with a lot of text messages between some of the players in that and the FBI, basically manufacturing this criminal panic and connecting it with the social democrats, the left of Ecuador, in a way to put more U.S. friendly people in power. Like, I believe the president now is from Miami.
Cool.
And so I'll put that in the show notes. And I think that's related in the sense that there's this international kind of pressure on destroying working class movements and internationalism as a way of protecting this emerging right wing order that finds most of its justification on law and order politics, on crushing insurgents, whether they be like criminal gangs or Hamas or what have you. And it's always interesting to see a look behind the scenes, which Dropsite News did a really good job of doing that. So I'll put that in the show notes.
Are we out of time for the main episode?
Just about.
Just about, yeah. I wanted to talk about the IF Day in Germany. And,
okay, well,
and
how also, about this?
Let's do it on the other side, maybe.
Yeah, we'll do a little bit more of this on the other side of the paywall, patreon.com/theAntifada. You can sign up for $5. You can sign up for $10 and get a big discount if you pay that annually. And we also have free memberships that will give you some of our member posts, but most of it you're going to want to pay $5 or $10 a month. So
and
appreciate it when you do.
And folks, I'd be really remiss if I did not announce real quick that ILC Chicago is a fucking thing. And in fact, we have a venue and a date for the first meeting. The core group of people in Chicago who are coming out strong ask you to meet in Chicago Sunday, September 29th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the West Loop Library branch of the Chicago Public Library, meeting in the meeting room. So if you're around, and we'll announce this again when it gets closer to the date, Chicago Sunday, September 29th, ILC Chicago is a go. We have great hopes and expectations for what's going on in Chicago.
Get loud in the library.
That's it.
Where you going? Well, I'm going to Alaska. Alaska? Well, what are you going there for? Yeah. Well, I saw a picture of it once, and Alaska looked all white and snowy. I heard it was cleaner there. Cleaner? Cleaner than what? Well, pretty soon, you know, everybody will be wanting to go there, and it will not be so clean anymore. In fact, I just don't want to talk about this anymore.